Support for this podcast and the following message come from Dignity Memorial. When your celebration of life is prepaid today, your family is protected tomorrow. Planning ahead is truly one of the best gifts you can give your family. For additional information, visit dignitymemorial.com.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Leslie Manville is an actor. She got her start on TV in the 70s. At the time, she was a teenager in England. Then she had a career in theater. She's been in many plays with the prestigious Royal Shakespeare Company. She's also known for her work with the director Mike Leigh. She starred in some of his best movies like Secrets and Lies, All or Nothing, and Another Year. These days, you can catch her on the newest season of The Crown. She plays Princess Margaret. When Leslie Manville and I talked in 2019, she had just wrapped up the third and final season of the BBC show Mum. In it, she plays Kathy, a mom in her 50s, living out in the suburbs. The show begins with Kathy getting over the recent death of her husband. The tone of the show and Leslie's performance are both grounded, though sometimes she is surrounded by madness. A lot of Mum is about Leslie's character's relationship with her best friend, Michael. They have significant romantic chemistry, but Leslie's son, Jason, isn't into the idea of the two of them hooking up. He's still protective of his late father, and he gets a bit jealous when he notices there might be something going on between his mom and his dad's pal. In this clip, Kathy and Jason are chatting after a dinner party wraps up. Kathy has maybe had too many drinks.
A little bit giggly, wasn't I?
Just a bit.
And then I fell asleep.
No, you were fast asleep on the sofa.
Oh, God.
Well, actually, last night, the really funny thing was you fell asleep on Michael.
How do you mean?
Well, we were watching the film and you fell asleep with your head on Michael's shoulder.
Oh, did I?
Yeah, not like you.
Oh, dear.
Well, everyone saw it. You think Michael would have moved or something. But he just sat there.
Did he?
Yeah.
Weird.
Well, Leslie, I'm so happy to have you on Bullseye. Thank you for coming in and doing this.
You're welcome. Thank you.
One of the things that I enjoy the most about Mum is you and Peter Mullen, the protagonists of the show, both radiate kindness and warmth. And it's a very muted, quiet show for a sitcom.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone else is a monster. Just act like monsters.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, they do. I think that was the point that, you know, you'd have this calm center to it with these people that the audience can really relate to, and particularly with Kathy, see the other people around her through her eyes and their ridiculousness and their characteristics, which sometimes are very challenging. But yeah, it is this sweet couple who have slowly, over the three seasons that we've done, fallen in love with each other, and it's a very nice love story.
Are you as patient as your character, Kathy, on Mum?
Hell no. I'm far more judgmental than Kathy is. Yeah, no, I find it hard to button my mouth. I really do, in all walks of my life. So, I mean, there are a lot of similarities. You know, I hope people think I'm kind and all of those things, but patient, no.
You left general education in your, like, mid-teens, right? 15 or 16, something like that?
15, yeah.
Had you already then decided to be an actor?
No, I was a very good classical singer. And since the age of about 8 or 9, I was trained classically. And I really did have an exceptional voice. And I think if I'd have taken that course, which would have been a very natural course to take, I would have moved into opera easily.
How did you figure out that that was the case when you were 8 or 9 years old? Was it like singing in church or something like that?
Well, I did actually go to a church school, but yeah, and so I did sing in the choir and I did sing a lot of solos. My father had a very good voice, so there was always singing at home, and my middle sister sang as well. So there was a lot of singing going on. And when I went to have singing lessons, you know, the teachers that I had were getting me to sing more complicated stuff and Mozart. And so it became apparent early on that I had this good voice. But, you know, I didn't grow up in a middle-class household. We were working class. We weren't poor, but we were working class. My father did all sorts of jobs, and my mother was stayed at home and looked after the three of us. But nobody really, well, nobody did take me to the opera. So I made a really ill-informed decision that it was boring, having not seen it ever, having never seen an opera in my life.
I'm going to be frank with you. I worked at the San Francisco Opera when I was a teenager. I was 16, 17 years old. Mm-hmm. I don't think you would have found it not boring at the time. I can't promise you, my experience as a 16-year-old at the opera.
There must be a lot of 15, 16-year-olds that do see it and do want to go and study it, because by the time they're 20, they're doing it. But, you know, I mean, for me, you know, it was... It just wasn't rock and roll for me, you know, at all. So I thought, well, look, I have got this good voice. I could use it. I could do musicals. So I sort of said to my mum and dad, look, I grew up in Brighton, which is on the south coast of England. I said, I really want to go to a stage school in London, which is a kind of odd place where you can go from four. And you do general education in the morning and then singing, dancing, acting in the afternoon. Well, I left school at 15 to go to this stage school with the idea that I would continue my education in the mornings, and I did. But the education was not good, so I didn't end up sitting any exams or doing any of the things that the friends I'd left behind in Brighton were doing. So I actually don't have a qualification to my name, so thank God I can act. But the singing and dancing and acting teaching was very good. And I learned to dance with a great choreographer called Arlene Phillips. I was singing and I met a really good acting teacher who I'm still friends with now. And I was only there for about 9 months or so. And then I left, and my first job was a musical in the West End directed by John Schlesinger, the late film director, who was making a very rare foray into a musical theatre. And then I did all sorts of odd jobs. I was presenting a bit. I was doing pantomime, which is a thing we have in England. It's a Christmas show. I was doing a bit of acting here and there, but it was mostly musical stuff. I did a lunchtime soap for a while, which was really interesting learning curve, because we shot most of it outside on proper single camera film, which was quite rare for television. Anyway, that said, cut to 6 years later, and I'd had a very happy 6 years just bumbling around, doing lots of different jobs, enjoying myself, earning a bit of money. And then I met Mike Lee, and then it all kind of changed, really, because we just got on like a house on fire, and he made me see that I could play people that weren't like me. And that made me more happy than anything. And I loved the way he worked, and the fact that, you know, to get to an end result of a script, we'd get to that point by many improvisations and creating characters and all of that. And I just loved it. And it made sense to me. I thought, yeah, if I'm going to play somebody real, I need to create them from scratch and fill out all their background and all of this stuff. So It really got into my bones, and working with him then at that very formative time, it was like the first film I did with him was made for the BBC, and it was called Grown Ups. And when it went out, despite the fact I'd been acting for about 6 or 7 years by then, it was like I was a new kid on the block, because the kind of work I'd been doing before that, nobody'd really noticed. But suddenly here I was with this prestigious director and doing this great film that was on the BBC. And, you know, after that, it just my career just got more and more interesting and went from strength to strength.
We'll be back in just a second. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
The Indicator from Planet Money is a daily podcast that helps you make sense of what's happening in the economy. And video games are a growing slice of that economy, with billions of people around the world identifying as gamers. That's why we're dedicating a week-long series to the growing business of video games. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Carvana, on a mission to make car buying more convenient and affordable than ever before. In minutes, you can browse thousands of options under $20,000. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today to get started.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beats. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking with the great Leslie Manville. You might know her from the films of director Mike Leigh. She starred in Another Year, Vera Drake, and All or Nothing. She also received an Academy Award nomination for her part in The Phantom Thread. These days, you can see her on the fifth season of The Crown, in which she plays Princess Margaret. When we talked in 2019, she just wrapped up the final season of the TV show Mum. Let's get back into our chat.
It seems to me like a lot to go off and do all that stuff on your own as a teenager. You know, particularly if you don't already have a lot of grounding in that world. I mean, having grown up outside London in a non-show business family, I have a buddy that grew up in Sherman Oaks, California here. When I got to college and became my friend, his parents are screenwriters and his neighbor as a child was Bryan Cranston. And to him, working in show business is normal.
Yes.
He still does. He does now. But like, I went to an art school as a teenager. I couldn't conceive that it could be a thing you did for your life. Like, maybe I could kind of imagine regional theater. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. Well, I mean, when I went to stage school, I really just loved it. I mean, I was still living at home in Brighton, and it's about an hour's commute on the train every day. So I was traveling backwards and forwards, but I loved it. I felt I'd found my groove. I mean, I was quite shy. I mean, there were a lot of girls there that were very jazz hands and loved performing, and they were very big characters. And I wasn't any of those things. But I always was the quiet one, really. But I suppose when I did feel, I know that when I did feel a bit lost and a bit alone was when I started working. And I wasn't working in London, which I was beginning to get to know, and I wasn't working near home in Brighton. I was all over the place, all over the country. And I was really quite alone then, and that was difficult. 16 years old, fending for myself. There was a program I did in the southwest of England, which was like a kids' show, but I was presenting it. So I'd film all these extracts during the week, you know, going to a zoo, talking to the zookeeper, and then we'd go into the studio once a week and we'd record the show live. I don't know if you have a comparison show here, but that was the nature of the show. It's kind of a magazine program for kids. And I loved doing the show, but nobody there looked after me at all. And in hindsight, it was shocking that nobody took care of me. And I was staying in a really not very nice hotel, which back in the, when was this then? This was the mid-late 70s. It was all a bit seedy, and it was full of traveling salesmen in terrible smelly suits and blokes and men who would look at me at breakfast. And it was really not very comfortable. And there were no mobile phones, cell phones. There were no TVs in the room. I mean, it was basic. And I was lonely and finding places to eat on my own in the evenings when restaurants were not really a thing, and certainly not 16-year-old girls going out on their own to eat. But, you know, I did it. So I suppose I kind of, it gave me backbone and it gave me an absolute sense of myself. And I think that it's been really good that I had all of that. I mean, it wasn't always great at the time, but it's kind of made me. You know, I don't take any mess from anybody. And I know that those years of my life were really formative, you know, until I got in my mid-20s and, you know, got myself somewhere to live in London and got more settled, you know. Those early days of traveling around so young and were hard.
So what were the circumstances of you meeting the filmmaker Mike Lee, with whom you've worked so many times in the decades since?
Well, the circumstances were kind of odd. I was doing a play in London for the Royal Shakespeare Company. I wasn't doing Shakespeare because they don't just do Shakespeare. I was doing a new modern play. And Mike had been asked to go to the Royal Shakespeare and do a play. But for various reasons, he had to cast it, economic reasons, I guess, he had to cast it from within the current company. And I don't think I was an obvious candidate. You know, I, as I said, prior to meeting him, I was kind of a one-trick pony.
I read him describe what you had done to that point as playing nice ladies like yourself or something like that.
Yeah, no, he's absolutely right. That is the bottom line. I played, you know, sweet, nice-looking girls, squeaky clean, and that was me. Anyway, he asked me to do this play. And I don't think he thought I was going to be a great Mike Lee candidate, really. I think he thought it was going to be a bit hard work with me. But once we started doing it, as I said just now, I just thought this was amazing. And I loved it and I was good at it. And he was the first person, after being an actor for about 7 years by that point, he said to me, "You're really very good at this." And the sense of achievement that I had and the thrill of him saying that to me was huge. So the play actually, for reasons which we don't need to waste time talking about now, actually never happened. So he said, "Well, look, I think you better come and work with me again." And then we did, in the days when he was mostly making films for the BBC and Channel 4, we made Grown Ups.
Now, he is very well known for his unusual method of making films and theater, which often involves developing characters and a story with the cast through, in part, improvisation.
Mm-hmm.
Had you improvised before you started working with him?
Only at stage school a little bit, but not really, not extensively. And it was never to do with it coming out of a character that you'd created. I mean, when you work with Mike, you don't just kind of day one start improvising. I mean, you spend many weeks creating a character that you're just talking about and chewing over with each, you know, each one-to-one. And then you start improvising. And even then, it's on your own. You don't start suddenly improvising with people. So I, you know, with him, I kind of realized that, of course, I always used to find improvising without Mike a bit of a waste of time. Because, and subsequent people that I worked with after having done a few jobs with Mike used to think, "Oh, you're good at improvising. Come on, let's try and make this scripted play that doesn't work very well at this point. Let's improvise it and see what." And of course, it's nonsense, because all you're doing is thinking what to say. So nothing can be trusted. Nothing's coming from an organic place. You're just trying to think of what to say. And of course, with him, with Mike, what's imperative is that you thoroughly and wholly create these characters, and then very slowly. I mean, you're just, you know, a whole day just walking around as them, not saying anything. Then you might just potter, you know, you have mock-ups of wherever they live or where they work. And you slowly, slowly, slowly start to bring them to life. And eventually, there'll be other characters in the piece that he'll bring you together with that you might be related to or having a friendship or marriage with, whatever. And you fill out all of that backstory, and then you'll start to do some improvisations, but there's never any pressure. In fact, it's absolutely crucial that you don't try and make the improvisations interesting, because then you're not going to discover anything. And I've done very long improvisations with him, where not a lot happens. But through those, he starts to see where tensions are, where relationships are floundering, or where a relationship is good. You know, I've done 4, 5, 6 hour improvisations where you might just, an hour of that might be spent with your characters sitting watching TV and not saying anything.
That's terrifying to me.
Yeah, but you haven't done the work that precedes it to get you to the place where
you're being presumptive, but in this case, you're
comfortable.
Right.
But, you know, that, of course, if somebody said to me tomorrow, okay, we're going to do this piece and you're going to be there, so let's start improvising, I'd be terrified, because that is what I was saying just now. All you're doing is thinking of what to say. Whereas if there's no pressure of being to be entertaining, it kind of takes care of itself because of the work you've done.
We'll wrap up with actor Leslie Manville after a quick break. When we return, we'll talk about her work in the brilliant Mike Leigh film, Another Year. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Across America, history is often recorded on small markers. You've probably seen them on the sides of roads, in front of buildings, in the middle of nowhere. NPR's Laura Sullivan spent a year investigating thousands of markers and found a distorted version of America's history, but also curiosities, humor, and joy. Listen to the new episode of The Sunday Story on the Up First podcast from NPR.
I'm Iffy Wadiwe, the host of Maximum Film.
I'm Alonzo Duralde, also the host of Maximum Film.
And I'm Drea Clark, yet another host of Maximum Film. Every week, we hosts huddle up,
usually with an illustrious guest,
and we talk about films.
We have film news.
We have film quizzes.
We answer your film questions.
It's like the maximum amount of film talk. That's why we call it
Maximum Film.
Maximum Film, the movie podcast that's not just a bunch of straight white guys. New episodes weekly on MaximumFun.org.
This is Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Leslie Manville of Phantom Thread, Another Year, and the latest season of The Crown. Let's get back into our chat. I want to play a scene from a Mike Leigh movie in which you start. And I'm going to be honest, we've only got a certain amount of time here. I could just play clips of your performances in Mike Leigh movies for the rest of the time we're here. I would be happy about that. I'd be perfectly glad to just sit here and enjoy your performances in Mike Leigh movies. But we picked one called Another Year that came out about a decade ago.
Yes.
And I was walking back to my car after having eaten lunch today. And I was thinking to myself, and this is, you know, don't ask me to defend it, but I do sincerely believe it. I was thinking to myself, I don't know that I have ever seen a more, I can't even meet your gaze while I say this, but it's the honest truth. I don't know that I've ever seen a more compelling acting performance in a film than your performance in this film.
Well, thank you very much.
Which I found just to be a breathtaking movie. So in this movie, basically, there is this couple named Tom and Jerry, who are in like late middle age. And one of Jerry's co-workers is Mary, who you play. And she is spending time with them and trying to put up a facade of, you know, of bonhomie. But it is very clear as the film unfolds that she is just desperately sad and lonely and probably an alcoholic.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
And so I just want to play this scene from the movie. So this is my guest as Mary talking about her taste in men over a glass of wine with Jerry. And Mary says that she's never dated a man who would cook for her.
You could put an ad in the paper. Chef wanted.
Yeah. Chef stroke boyfriend required for gorgeous girl. No, mature woman with cat. No, mature-ish. We don't want to put them off, do we? Oh, it's really lovely the way you and Tom do everything together.
We're very lucky.
Yeah, you are. But you deserve it. You're both such lovely people.
Oops. Me hello, Sophie.
Yeah, St. Jerry. No, but I'm really comfortable with where I am in my life. As you know, I've got my lovely little garden flat. I've got a good job. I've got my health, touch wood. I've got my independence. I haven't got anybody telling me what to do. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's not all rosy. I have good days and bad days like everyone else, don't I? But hey.
It is. I think it would be very easy for your performance or the film to just let her be pathetic or just let her be a joke. And it's a funny movie too.
Yeah.
And it doesn't. And I wonder what it was like to spend all that time developing and then embodying a character who is in some ways just defined by just crippling loneliness.
Yeah. I think that film stayed with me. I don't mean on a day-to-day basis. I mean, I didn't go home and cry into my pillow because I was playing Mary. But that woman stayed with me, her predicament, her pain. Because so many people said to me when they'd seen the film that they'd been like that at times in their life, or they knew people that were like that, or people that were like that and were still like that. And I sort of think that for me, she was the most complete piece of work that I did with Mike, really. When we were doing big parts of the film, like, for example, the scene when she arrives late to their barbecue.
We've saved you some food, Mary. I hope it's still warm.
Oh, thanks, Jerry. Oh, yeah, it'll be fine.
Please, and fresh if you like.
Oh, no, Tom, don't worry about me.
You didn't get arrested then, Mary?
No, I didn't, Joe. He was very kind to me, actually.
What CC is your car?
What do you mean?
How big's the engine?
Oh, I don't know. It's about this big, I think. What's so funny?
Don't be cruel.
It means how powerful is it, Mary? How many cubic centimetres is it?
Oh.
You should know that.
On the back, there's numbers like 1.6 or 1.9.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah, well, that's boy stuff, isn't it?
It's not important.
No, Tanya. I think I'm going to have a cigarette before I eat this.
Excuse me, I'll get out of your way.
Shall we take Isaac over there?
Okay.
Oh, well, I thought you wouldn't mind because we're outside.
No, we don't, Mary. You carry on.
You're all right.
And we did that as a major improvisation that lasted the best part of the day, really. So, you know, for Mary, it would start in her flat, getting ready, you know, all of that. And I remember this very well, and I don't remember lots of things, but this I remember very well. That Mary used to listen to a lot of sad Dusty Springfield, and she used to sing along to it quite well, which was good because, you know, I've got a bit of a voice on me, and I thought, actually, I'm going to use it. Mary can have quite a good voice. She's belting out this, and she sort of loved the loneliness in a perverse way. You know, she loved singing the Dusty Springfield and crying and using that as an excuse to go and get another glass of wine, and even though she knew she had to drive across London, because then she arrives in this car that she's got, and the car is everything's chaos with her. Chaos. Nothing is ordered, and that's really not like me. I'd never played somebody drunk before. And we did a few scenes where she was drunk, and that, oddly enough, it was the only time, and I'd shared this with Mike, I said, the really thing I'm finding really tricky is that normally, you know, you do the scene, you come out of character, you go and have your lunch, and you come back and you do it again, whatever. But when I was doing the drunk Mary, I sort of needed to stay in that zone. I found going in and out of drunk very tricky. So he said, that's all right, you know, just we'll find a little place for you to go and keep it on the go. And I did. And it really helped. But there was a lot about playing her. And I think over the years, some people have misinterpreted this, that it meant that, you know, I was lonely or I was, you know, in some sort of pain. And we've all been in pain in our lives and lonely at times. But I really knew how to play her. I brought a lot to those scenes when she was desperate, and it kind of was an extension. It was like going to places beyond where I, Leslie, had been, but I knew the route. So yeah, we have a show in England called Desert Island Discs. You might be familiar with my Desert Island Disc. My movies would be Mary. But that's because there's something so wonderful about her as well, that she isn't just totally pitiful, and she wants to present something to the world that is positive. You know, she hasn't completely thrown in the towel. She clings to, she's going to claw herself back up, you know, or try to.
And she's beloved too. I mean, like that's mm. another thing about the film is that she wouldn't be there even in that state if those friends didn't love her.
Yes. I mean, they do eventually get rather irritated because she's interrupting the kind of order and family stability of their life. You know, here's this tornado that turns up on a Sunday. And behaves quite badly at times, especially towards their son and his new girlfriend.
You know, one of the themes that movie shares with Mum is kind of engaging with the question of what are the possibilities and lack of possibilities of late middle age?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like that, another year... It feels like this story of contrasts of people, these people who are engaging that part of their lives in very different ways.
Mm.
You know, Mum is about someone who has both like learned to be generous with everyone around her and is also being generous with herself about starting a new thing, having lost her husband.
Mm-hmm.
And another year feels like a really deep, at least felt to me when I watched it, like a very deep engagement of the tragedy of late middle age, which is that you don't always get to make a new choice. You don't always get to open up a new road.
No. I mean, obviously, Mary in another year was about 10 years ago, so I was 10 years younger. So there was something more desperate about Mary. And you're right, those comparisons are absolutely spot on, but she was... You know, the ship had sailed to have a child, and she was just a different personality. You know, she desperately wanted to cling on to her youth and her looks, and you know, she dressed. Some would say, some would not, but she probably dressed a bit inappropriately for her age, and she wasn't very sophisticated. She wasn't embracing getting older, and which she could have done. You know, she was not a bad-looking woman. She was just desperately clinging on and really totally misjudging the situation with her friend's son, who she seriously thought she could get into some kind of relationship and that he would find her attractive and want to be with her. And it's not that she wasn't attractive, but it was that there was no way this stable young man was going to be attracted by this totally chaotic, alcoholic, desperate woman. And what's different about Kathy and Mum is that she has had a full and fulfilled life. She was married to a man who she had a good relationship with. She had love. She's had a child. She does... a nice job. She works in a children's school. You know, that it's all gentle, positive things. So her reevaluation of her life post the death of her husband is a very different scenario. But what I love about Mum And what's, I think, one of the reasons why it's been received so enthusiastically and brilliantly, certainly in the UK thus far, is that it looks at people over 50, over 60, who are just forming a love affair. You know, they're that part of their lives is not shut off and done with. And it's, I think a lot of women are very happy to see something like that portrayed, that they feel they're being represented. And also that, you know, as I've said in the press before, in a slightly exaggerated way, because I'm trying to make a point, you know, in a Guardian interview recently, I kind of, in a rather extravagant way, said, I want to go out and dance till 3 a.m. and get drunk and drink too much and have sex, you know, which is kind of, people have taken a bit literally. But I'm sort of making a point that, you know, just because you are over 50, it doesn't mean that those feelings stop and that you don't, you know, you don't want a good time. You don't want to misbehave. You know, some people think, oh, well, you're a 50-year-old woman. Should you really be dancing and getting sweaty and flirting? Hell yes, you should. And if you want to, you can do it. I mean, Kathy's not like that, obviously. She's much more well-behaved and she wouldn't even think that she would go out and get drunk. She'd probably stay at home and get drunk, but she might not want to go dancing like I do. But it's just, you know what I'm saying. I'm just, isn't it great that... like Fleabag is about a woman of a very different generation, but who's the great thing about that show is that she doesn't care, you know, that anything goes, and that the show has shown a woman of that age not caring. It's just breaking some glass ceilings, really.
Well, Leslie Manville, thank you so much for being on Bullseye. It's so, so great to get to talk to you.
Thank you. It's been really nice talking to you, too.
Leslie Manville from 2019. You can catch her in the most recent season of The Crown. That's on Netflix. The British sitcom in which she starred, Mum, is on Hoopla and BritBox, among other platforms. And hey, I'm going to drop a recommendation here. If you've never seen Another Year, it is just an absolute character masterpiece. It is funny and sad and sweet. It's just an incredible movie, and Leslie is extraordinary in it. So go rent that. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. Although I will say today, I was in our office at MacArthur Park because my daughter got obsessed with the idea of buying a bootleg DVD. So I bought for $2 on MacArthur Park a bootleg copy of Star Wars The Last Jedi. Ryan Johnson, if you're listening, my apologies, I owe you $2. Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Our producers are Jesus Ambrosio and Richard Roby. Our production fellows at Maximum Fun are Tabitha Myers and Brianna Paz. We get help booking from Mara Davis. Our interstitial music is by DJ W, a.k.a. Dan Wally. Our theme song is Huddle Formation by the band The Go Team. Thanks to The Go Team. Thanks to their label, Memphis Industries. Bullseye is on YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. You can follow us in any of those places. We will share our interviews with you. And we do hope that if you heard something you enjoyed on this week's show, you'll share it with somebody. I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
In this country, more than 2 local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. 6 big ones could help decide the election. Guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.
If you've never donated to the NPR network before, that's okay. Public radio is available to everyone for free. But we do rely on listener support from those who are able to give. So join the community of supporters for Public Media Giving Days, coming up on May 1st and 2nd. Please give at donate.npr.org, and thank you.